everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors for you to mention here at the top of the show. One of them is the SAS Summit, like S lowercase ASS. You know, like the Syntastically Awesome Style Sheets, although do they even call them that anymore? I think they got rid of that. But anyway, the preprocessor, you know, like the best one that everybody uses, and the cool hip thing to do these days is to use SAS plus post CSS, you know, that thing. Yeah, well, they're having a summit for it. Environments for Humans are doing an online conference all about SAS. It's literally, the URL is sassummit.com. It's the 2015 version of it. Let's see what date is. November 18th and 19th. So get your ducks in a row and attend it. It's a two-dayer because there's a lot to say about SAS. And it's SAS, but it's CSS and it's architecture and it's other preprocessors and it's the whole conversation that goes around all of that. You know, really great stuff. If you sign up for it, make sure to use Shop Talk Show for 25% off. Again, that's sassummit.com. And
LYNDA.com.
I love how we get slightly worse and worse at that every time. But you know what gets better and better over time is the actual website. We're talking about lynda.com. It really is lynda.com/shoptalk, which gets you to the free 10-day free trial to check out, you know, the world's largest repository of video training courses, essentially. Pretty dang fantastic. So, yeah, whether you want to set new financial goals, find work-life balance, invest in a new hobby, ask your boss for a raise, find a new job, improve upon your current job skills, any of that stuff, lynda.com has something for everybody. I picked out some. I went through and picked out some ones that I want to watch and added them to my Lynda playlist, and I'll tell you what they are later in this show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
That's right, everybody. It's kind of a classic episode. I'm sure you're familiar with the type now. I believe it's the 53rd one in this little mini series we're doing called Rapid Fire. That's right. Another thing that's gotten worse over time are
rapid fire sounds.
Rapid fire sounds. That's how we like it around here. What it means is we're going to do more questions than we normally do because the meat and potatoes, as we say, of Shop Talk Show is your, dear listener, questions that you send in to us. It's pretty darn fabulous. You'll know this season we've been messing with the format a little bit, but rapid fire is always going to stick around. You know why? Mostly because I like doing shows with just Dave. You know, I like all of our formats, but it's nice to just be able to just talk with just Dave sometimes.
It used to be a massive cop-out, and now it's kind of something to look forward to.
Right.
The
symbol of our long-term friendship.
Coming up on 4 years now of the Shop Talk Show, let's get into it.
Mr. Brian Lee writes in, thanks for taking my question. I'm a front-end web designer and developer working for a small agency in the Bay Area of California. We just hired a very vocal and opinionated junior developer, and I'm getting him associated with my SAS. Speaking of the SAS Summit, SAS, he's talking about the preprocessor here. My current workflow with SAS involves running Grunt on my local machine, processing the SAS file locally, and uploading the rendered CSS to the remote web server. Makes sense, right? The new developer insists that we run SAS remotely on the server and have a watch folder set up. In the 2 years that I've been writing SAS, I've never considered running SAS on the remote server and working in this way. He says, in a way, he's right, and it's a somewhat logical to have the remote server process the files for you, but is this the optimal way to go about it? Do people really process their SAS files on the remote server? What are the pros and cons of this workflow? I've been doing the same for maybe about the same number of years, maybe a little bit longer. Never heard of it. I've heard of people running Git on their server. I've heard of a few things running on the server, but I don't think I've ever seen a workflow that involves processing SAS on the server. Have you, Dave?
No, I mean, maybe you have like a build step on the target server or something that does something.
Why?
But well, like a post commit hook, like, okay, I will, you know, I will go get the repo. I will build like the necessary steps, and then I will whatever.
Just because it's built into the build record. Step and why not kind of thing or something.
Yeah.
I guess.
Mean, yeah. Like, but I think generally
make the build step do that locally. I mean, it just seems like what's the real reason? Is it because I have a feeling it's like, well, this is a way to keep the compiled CSS out of the repo, which is a thing, kind of, right?
You should probably do that.
I like that. I mean, I don't really care that much because I just don't. Like, I feel like sometimes people are like a little sanctimonious about like what's in Git and what isn't, and like how merges are handled and stuff. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe it's just, you know, DevOps people just, you know, I rely on their intelligence anyway. So I guess I don't have to worry about it. But anyway, so how do you do that? Let's say your goal is keeping compiled CSS out of Git, because it really, there's no advantages necessarily to having it there. So I guess I can understand that. How would you do it if you don't have SAS run on the server?
If you don't have SAS run on the server?
Because you need to deploy the compiled SAS.
Yeah.
But it's not in Git. I mean, so it's kind of like a little confusing, because normally you just like you deploy whatever's in Git.
Yeah, I don't know. That's where like the build step would come in, right? Like you'd need the remote server to run a grunt thing when it gets code. But this one made it sound like you have a server that's running SAS watch on a folder, and then you just, as soon as you deploy it to that folder, it just recompiles SAS, right?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of makes
that's
sense.
What it sounded like you were doing. SAS watch was like your build step, and I guess technically there's nothing wrong with that but I don't know. It just seems
well, I mean, the problem with it being that now you have SAS that's running in a slightly different environment than your local environment is maybe, and you have SAS, you can't ask the server to compile SAS for you when you're working locally. That would be super weird. So now you have two installs of SAS that are different, you know, that could potentially get out of sync from each other, which might be weird. And like, what if SAS watch stops working on that server? Do you need to then like be always watching that and making sure that it's okay? And
yeah, that sounds like a hassle. I mean,
it does. It seems like pre-processing is this thing that's kind of meant to happen on your local machine. But yeah, whatever.
I think a lot of people like build a distribution-y kind of folder.
I mostly thought the question was funny that he's like, I have a very vocal and opinionated junior developer.
You know what I did immediately? I started Googling Dunning-Kruger effect, which is basically the cognitive bias wherein relatively unskilled individuals suffer from illusory superiority, mistakenly assessing their ability to be much higher than is accurate.
maybe a little Dunning-Kruger going on.
Not throwing this person under the bus, but it's a, you know, it's kind of common that there is a like, I can do it. What's wrong? I know the best. But that's how you should also learn from people. Chris, you hired people younger than you. They're smart. They're sharp people.
Right.
So,
and of course, the answer the danger is the very loud and opinionated thing has it's clearly rubbing Brian the wrong way here a little bit. Otherwise, you wouldn't have phrased it like that. So, but of course, the real answer is like this. There's points being like, can you assess why you want to do this, and what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages, and maybe it does make sense and maybe it doesn't. And like, those conversations, of course, are a little more boring than people throwing plates across the room.
Isn't the like smoke test like what could go wrong? And if they can't think of anything that would go wrong, you're like, let's not do it because if you need to know like what can go wrong. So that's what I would ask. So
here's a mini story. I know this is supposed to be rapid fire, so let's do that. But there's one, there's some stuff changing, you know, even changing at CodePen as we hire more people and we have to like, you know, be more adult-like in our development process or whatever, like we were just joking about. But Or I guess that joke happened on Code Pen Radio, actually. I'm a little my joke is
crossover
indeed. I do another podcast. It's called Code Pen Radio. It's about all things Code Pen, but it's fun. We were talking a little bit about
I do another podcast with my friend Paul. He gets really drunk and talks about things.
2 minutes. Paul. Oh, good. Please listen to that.
Oh boy.
But it was about how we can't, you know, like, okay, the days of committing to master are officially over, like over, like don't do it anymore. And not only don't do it, but cut a branch for every little thing that you do, even if you're changing a Z index from a 5 to a 50 or something, make a new branch, call it, I had to change the Z index from 5 to 50. Make a proper commit, name the commit properly, then do a pull request to master, explain what you did in it. And then we got CodeShip running, which is that thing. You remember we had those fellas back on
episode?
Yeah. And now CodeShip is running our tests. So then it's integrated into GitHub, and GitHub won't let you merge it until it passes. Which, did you even know that it works like that? It's so cool.
Yeah, man.
And then it, once it passes, then you can click the merge button, and then it comes in. And it's just like this very, it's this thing that we had to do because I forget how this is related to the, I had a very way that it was connected to what we were just talking about. But
the kind of what could go wrong sort of stuff?
Or it's just like,
you're trying to mitigate that?
Yeah, just, you know, I think the point is like, it's like slower, and it's me like being forced into doing something that like doesn't, I don't know. Like it's a little bit of a pain in the ass to me. Like I have to change the Z index. I really did have to change the Z index from 5 to 50. And instead of it being this like really easy thing that with seemingly no downside for me to just pop into master and just do it and deploy it, I have to not do that anymore. And it's kind of like, ugh. But it's kind of like, well, but there's so many good reasons that we do this that we just kind of have to do it. It's, you know, I forget what.
No, I think that's part of the team aspect of web design, right? Is you pick up things from other people. You have to learn how to do things that push you out of your comfort zone. I think it's good.
These conversations happened around preprocessors not that long ago. Like, why do I have to use this thing now?
Mm-hmm.
Conversation changes, though. All right, let's do more questions. You want to play live?
An audio question from Andy McCormick. Here we go.
Hey guys, love the show. I was hoping that Dave could share a little bit about his rsync workflow for deploying his websites. Does he give himself the ability to roll back if anything goes wrong with the deploy? Does he allow rsync to delete files on the live server? What does that workflow look like? Is it just one simple rsync command, or is it a series of commands? Are there tests that he runs that are involved to make sure the build doesn't fail? Just trying to look for what that workflow looks like. Thanks a lot.
Don't you like not have rsync anymore?
Oh, I got it back. I found like a Windows implementation of it. It's kind of, it's paid software, but that's okay. So I use rsync to sling my files up to the web. That's like my favorite way to do it. And rsync is a Unix command that basically keeps two folders in sync, you know, and it doesn't care which folders. It just like goes through and like lists every file and every single subfolder and goes to the server and says, are you all the same here? And if not, I'm gonna like fix it all.
It's deployment, so, kind of, you could think of it that way if you use it for web stuff.
It's the same thing as your Time Machine or your Dropbox or something,
or
I mean, it's
like,
just rsync,
you know,
Beanstalk or something. Yeah. And so it just slings files across the web and it checks to see like what's out of date. And I think it prefers the most recent one or like whatever computer initiated the sync. I really like that. So it's fine. It just uploads. One thing that it doesn't do anything like rollbacks or anything fancy like that. That would all just be my computer. Like if I noticed something was wrong or visually or something like that, I just would like git rollback. I'd roll back on git and then re-push it up, re-rsync it up. And what I have working there is it's mostly just a rake task that I picked up. from Chris B on GitHub, Jekyll-template. He has a rake file where he had a deploy task and it rsynced with --rtzh --progress --delete_site username at server name. That's your username at your server name, and then var www vhost whatever website name sort of thing or whatever. Yeah. So it's cool. It uploads over SSH. So that's cool. And I was having trouble. My problem was Windows doesn't have that, or rsync or SSH native. So you have to kind of cobble things together. But I'm using a program called AcroSync, which is actually a GUI, which stinks. it stinks that it's like just a GUI to do something I can do from the command line. But it is, it's the same sort of, all the parameters are the same, and you just, I just can click a button to upload my site, which sounds sort of weird, but what's cool about AcroSync is it's actually scriptable. So I might just edit my rake task to like trigger upload this profile. When like the DaveRuper.com profile, whenever I do like deploy Windows or something, Win deploy or something. That's probably what I'll do.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Hopefully that answered your question. I mean, it's not, it sounds like Andy's got fancier stuff going on. Like I think.
Well, there's some interesting stuff here. Like the fact they have 100 sites. So it's kind of like, it does kind of make sense that you'd want to do something not like a paid
free
service. Yeah.
I like free. I mean, you know, but we pay for a dedicated virtual server, you know, and yeah, the servers at least, I mean, almost minimum $8 or something for a decent server, $10 a month, let's say. So you kind of have to factor that out. So, but you could also probably put 20 sites on a DV at Media Temple for, I don't know, like let's say $50 a month or something. So you got to kind of weigh the cost. So I don't know what deploy IO costs, but I thought they had kind of a free plan. So yeah, that's it.
Oliver Williams writes in, what's the best way of styling tooltips? Google doesn't come up with much. Have things moved on since the last CSS Tricks article in 2011? It seems very complicated for a much needed and simple effect. So I thought this would be interesting. It does seem like I wrote this down actually as an article to revisit, because it seems like there's a path of thinking here that you can follow, Oliver, that it occurs to me. And I wonder what Dave thinks of it too. But one of them is, so you think of a tooltip as, for one, it's a fine-grained pointer situation, right? There's not, tooltips aren't probably a great scenario for any kind of tap environment. You'd probably need like a, yeah, in a tap environment, you're,
yeah,
gonna need,
like you, touch it probably doesn't work.
No, but you could put like a question mark next to the thing that you could tap on if it was very important and it seemed like something that requires a little explanation. Certainly having a little icon, maybe a little SVG question mark in a circle or something that you can tap that pops something up, that's cool. So that's something to think about. And if that's the case, I think you have some more leeway there. But let's say it's a tooltip. Oftentimes, we think of a tooltip as just being a hover effect for like a mouse, like on a link. Like it looks just like an href. You can click it, and it's still a link. But as you hover it, something pops up to give you more information. It's a fairly common design pattern. Maybe less and less popular over time. Maybe thanks to touch. But let's say you want to style that. Well, I think the first question you should ask yourself, Oliver, is the title attribute alone acceptable? Like, do I, like when you hover over a thing with the title, can you picture the little yellow box that comes up in most browsers? Now that's unstyled, and no, you can't style that, but do you, who cares, right? Like, is, do you absolutely need to style that or not? And then if the answer is yes, I absolutely need to style that, is it just a string of text? So is it something that you could put in like a data attribute and then use the content, you know, the attribute function in CSS in a pseudo element to then use? And I say, is it just a string of text, meaning that it's not rich HTML? So some, if you think of a tooltip and you hover over it and it says, you know, Dave's a cool dude, that's great. It's just a string and there's nothing else to it. If there's a thing and there says Dave's a cool dude and it links Dave to DaveRupert.com, that's rich and you can't put that in an attribute on an A tag. You know, like you can't put an A tag in an A tag in HTML. It's like not going to work. So now you're in the situation where now maybe you're using a data attribute that like has a reference to an ID to a div elsewhere on the page that then through JavaScript it kind of, you know, positions, goes and gets the HTML from that div and puts it in the tooltip, and now you're in a position of needing to do fancy JavaScript positioning and stuff like that. So how much do you need these tooltips? And then
I like, that's the best way to put it. How much do you need these?
Well, it's, you know, and then the other thing is now once you've moved it away from a title attribute into a data attribute, it's less accessible because you can't leave the title attribute there because you can't fight it. It will be on top. There's like, it's like no matter how you try to z-index your way out of this, the title, the yellow box from title will be on top of it. So it's kind of like now you have to remove the title because you don't like how it looks because you're trying to replace it. Well, now you've removed the title attribute and you've removed the accessibility from it naturally. Now, you might want to Google around for accessible tooltips because maybe there's a way to kind of announce that the tooltip has showed up and, you know, change focus to it or whatever. But you're going to have to replicate natural accessibility. I feel like that's always a tough, you know, you're like, I want to style a dropdown. Okay, are you going to replace it with divs? Because if you do that, there's a lot to think about as far as maintaining what you get for free accessibility-wise through native browser things. And so this is like,
yeah,
you know, you really got to want this and you really got to do a good job if you do it.
I was going to say title is maybe don't use that. Most screen readers don't use that like because people used it terribly.
Oh, interesting. If you were really? Gonna, you'd use...
Yeah, like titles... pretty much don't use it.
That's funny though, like, because in SVG land, I have a new post about this coming up. Some people did some, I think it might be a little different in SVG. It seems to be like the really good one to use in SVG. The title tag, not the title attribute.
Title tag, not the title attribute. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could do, there's this thing called ARIA described by, which points to an ID of an element. And that would be like the most semantically maybe, way to do tooltips, but I don't know. The thing about tooltips is you can do like the content after, or you can do the kind of, but then like somebody's like, oh, could you get like a little arrow that points at it? And then you're like, yeah, sure. And then it's like, oh, but if you're on the left side of the screen, like, can the arrow point be on the right side?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Oh God. And then if they're on the right side of the screen, the right. Oh God.
There's CSS top solutions, but exactly, they don't do exactly what Dave's describing. You can't do logic from CSS very well. I was like, where is it appearing? So yeah, you're in a situation where you can't hide overflow then because
it's kind of just a hell of a lot of work.
There's great JavaScript libraries for it. So they exist, but then it's like, ugh, that's a whole thing. Do I want to load up jQuery UI for this? And probably not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
Oliver, you better want it and good luck with your journey. Let's do another one.
All right, David Barnes writes in, how do you guys seem to level up so quickly? I have been focused on learning JavaScript, jQuery, and PHP for a while now, and for whatever reason, I cannot get to the next level of understanding. I suppose it's because I do not spend enough time on it, but there's only so much time in the day. I have a wife and kids, and sometimes it can be difficult to find time to put towards leveling up. I think this question will resonate with other listeners because I feel like this is a common issue in web development.
This is kind of FAQ territory for Shop Talk Show. You know, it's kind of a, you know, sometimes we do just build websites and then we get people saying, I'm trying to just build websites, but it's not working kind of thing. But I think but then it's like just build websites kind of like, but you have a wife and kids and you level up. That's why I put this in here this time. Cause I was like, you know what? We just like in our last episode, you know, our last show, we were at CSS DevComp. Have you been to a conference lately, David? And Dave's got a wife and kids, but not only were you at a conference, but you spoke at a conference and didn't feel like that probably kind of forced you to, maybe do some leveling up of yourself because you were forced to, you know, think of something to share, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's sacrifice. I mean, you have to barter time from your family to work on this stuff. And that's, you know, I mean, I don't know that any spouse would or partner would ever just say, like, you're like, I want to be better at a thing. And they're going to be like, no, like that's kind of rough. But maybe your situation is different. So that's how I sort of fence the issue, you know. It's tough. But what I will say is you do have some time. I mean, like, if your kids wake you up at 5 o'clock to, like, watch TV, you have a little bit of time while they're watching Handy Manny, in my sense case. Cruise through the HTML5 weekly or the whatever that came into your inbox. Accessibility weekly is one I'm
sure
subscribed to now as well.
And that's not just keeping on, keeping on. Those things are showcasing the new.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of new hotness. And I would say about 60% of it works on your phone. Some of it you just miss out on, if you, like, follow CodePen, you know. It's great, but not everyone doing CodePen is like, I should make this really work really well on mobile. So sometimes I miss out on cool CodePens, but, you know, it's following the right Twitter accounts. I mean, heck, you want to know what's the new hotness? Flashback to 2006, dig.com. That's DIGG.com. Yeah. Dig Reader.
I'm man. Still
RSS
using
RSS readers.
It's pretty solid.
RSS readers. Because it's whenever you have a minute, you just read some articles and it's the best. You don't have to keep up with the.
Maybe we should share our OPML files or whatever. Stream. I just got done reorganizing mine and, like, getting rid of the old feeds and stuff. Because it is straight up just an RSS reader. But the actual Dig website and very nice mobile app is not only just an RSS reader, but then has, like, this home screen where it's just, like, good stuff, you know, like kind of old school Dig. And then it also has this connect your Twitter to it, like you were showing me, and it's got, and it kind of surfaces all the best stuff that your Twitter followers are sharing. It's, like, kind of awesome.
Yeah. Top stories for Davitron 5000. And it's like redesigning the toast from responsive web design, because they killed it on that. Facebook starts 2G Tuesdays. That's something totally, you know, if you didn't read that article, now's your time. NPR now twice as fast. That's NPR managed to, like, cut their mobile page speed time. More the toast. I follow Ethan and Karen McGrain, so there's quite a few of those. But yeah, angled edges with CSS masks from the Viget Labs thing, you know, a code push from Microsoft. I don't even know what that is, but I'm going to check it out later. RSS, man, it's like the lazy man's Twitter, and I love it. Isn't it the best? It's the best. It's all the fun of Twitter, or all the, like, knowledge vacuuming of Twitter without, like, having to catch up. So DIGG.com.
It was quite the ad. It is really sweet, though. You know what I need to know is whose job is it to write the sub byline for all the articles? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Like, it shows the title of the article, but then in, like, little all caps letters above it, it puts a little, like, sub headline, and they're, like, they're usually really funny. And there's just, like, 20 of them a day. Like, somebody's job is, like, just to write those things.
They have editors.
They must be. They're really good editors. Yeah.
So that I would recommend that. And if Dig wants to acquire Shop Talk Show, let's talk. How cool would it be to be the Dig podcast?
Oh, you could be Kevin Rose and I'll 50. Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. All right. Next. So anyway, next question. Hopefully that helps. I don't mean to be dismissive of your situation, but it is hard to, like, when your time is vacuumed up by other things. So next question comes from Brody Austin. Hi there. I work at a public library where we put on an annual event that runs for a few months, comingtogether.in. Each year the event has a different theme. Last year I built a microsite for the event basic info, event listing, community partners, etc. Yeah, that was very much
an event website, right?
Oh, for Yeah, yeah, an event website. Now I'm trying to figure out the best way to retheme it for this year's theme and content. What should I do with last year's content? Does last year's content need to retain the last year's theme? Do I move everything into a new subdirectory? Do I freeze the CSS, JS, etc.? To the site gets a few thousand visits during the course of the event, so I'm wondering how much time and effort I should really put into this. I'm using Jekyll gulps ass.
I'll tell you what to do. Exactly what to do. Make so last year was 2000. It'll be, if this is a 2016 event or whatever, last year will be this year, 2015. Make it 2015 dot whatever the website is .com. And yes, freeze exactly what you did. Make it exactly how it is. Maybe change it to like make clear that the event is over and this is archival. Maybe add a little note at the top or something. And then make the new website redirect to 2016. That event. So this is like the new system. Now you have a system. So if somebody goes to the raw website, they're automatically redirected to 2016.event.whatever. And then just use that system every year. I really like that rather than having just one URL that's just gets changed and the content kind of gets lost forever. I love it when websites do the year to year difference thing or come up with another taxonomy, but like keep it around. Because it's just kind of neat to it's nice for you. It's nice for the people that went to that event before to be able to check out and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the archival is pretty awesome, especially for an event, which is so year specific. The only problem will be what if you start throwing three events a year? Something.
Right, maybe, you need to do maybe taxonomy then. Like maybe name them differently or put the month and the year or whatever.
Yeah, but you know, if that happens, you might just, it might be
a problem to have.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have, but yeah, I mean, maybe there's some tagging that you need to do.
And, does it need to be styled exactly the same? Heck no. I'm all about switching stuff up. The web is all about change.
Change it up.
So, yeah.
Hopefully that helps. I mean, in Jekyll, it's as simple as you just make another folder, I mean, called 2015 and start writing pages in that or whatever, 2016.
Nice.
So it could be that just that easy for you.
It may not be. So subdomains is usually a little slightly more complicated because it requires some server stuff. But
you could fork the project, like just, you know, like straight up, like, shut that one down and fork it.
Need some kind of like URL plan for it. Not a big deal.
Yep.
So all I'm right. gonna do the SaaS Summit spot here. This is pretty cool. The URL to go to is literally SaaSSummit.com with the massive conglomeration of S's in the middle there. Three S's. SaaSSummit.com. Bring the experts to your desktop for an all new 2-day only conference. That's November 18th and 19th. Deep dive into SaaS sessions about web typography, attribute driven styles. Weird, right? Probably cool. Games, making listings, much more. Visit SaaSSummit.com to register. So there's going to be some sessions on post CSS. And mark my words, I think this is. I just saw. I'm even in the. I'm in like the SaaS Slack, and they were talking. And somebody was posting about there's a new post CSS module that runs them both together. You know, it's called post SCSS. It runs. You know, and it runs. But cool, you know,
like, it's good. Hey,
you don't like necessarily need it because your gulp setup can just, you know, it can just run gulp SAS and then run post CSS like it probably already is doing. But I think if I had to call the 2016 like preferred pre-processing setup, that's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing SCSS hold on to its strong lead. And people are still going to keep with that. And then post CSS sprinkled in the top. In fact, it probably already is sprinkled into your workflow because auto prefixer is post CSS. So you're probably already running auto prefixer. And then I think people are like going to get into these little kind of boutique post CSS plugins, like the one that allows you to like write SVG syntax in there, or the one that like handles all the Google font stuff for you and stuff. Like there's some really good ones. Jonathan Neal is like good at identifying little things like this and writing post CSS plugins for them. But that's what I'm calling in 2016 is this like SCSS post CSS thing. There's going to be talks about that at SaaS Summit. interaction with the speakers and fellow attendees, because it's just a chat room that's running the whole time, real-time Q&A. You get videos of all this stuff when you do it. And if you attend it, make sure you use Shop Talk Show as the code, because you get 20% off whatever tickets you kind of choose. So this is a live conference coming up November 18th and 19th that you attend through your web browser. All right, what do you got, Dave?
All right, next question comes in from Scott Fennell. Writes in, I have some JS running on a page every 300 milliseconds to do stuff. I'm worried that's going to result in some kind of poor performance, but I'm not sure what to look for. If I do it far more often, I can see CPU usage increase in activity and activity monitor quite a bit. And so that's
so if you do it every 200 milliseconds, he's seeing increase in CPU.
Yeah, like so if you opened like your task manager or your activity monitor, you'd see like the browser memory just kind of chucking.
Yeah, and it looks like he's using this buffer in Chrome Timeline, which I don't know what that is, but he puts a GIF to it, which we can link to.
What's the buffer thing in Chrome Timeline? Is that the browser getting sicker and sicker of doing the same thing?
Probably memory. I don't even know.
Yeah. I'm going to say I don't know is probably the correct answer. I don't know if that, because it's like you've probably seen it when you run a profile. It says buffer ... 1%, 2%, 3% or something, right? I don't know if that's like it's buffering like the amount of money the like recording that it's taking has access to, or if it's the amount of money that or memory, same def, or the amount of memory that your app is taking up. But it seems like if you closed Web Inspector or something, and every 300 milliseconds, like it's kind of getting more and more heinous, maybe you have a memory leak or something like that. A browser should be able to handle like a 300 millisecond timeout kind of okay, but you are like putting stress on the thread, but it should be fine. Like, I don't know what, I don't know what you're doing. That's the question. If you're like, I'm animating a chicken every 300 milliseconds. Well, I think you're doing a lot for the browser, but yeah, I don't know what you're doing every 300.
Which means there's a set timeout involved, which is like, isn't there? So this needs to be, this seems like kind of like a Paul Lewis thing to address kind of thing. Cause he's often, is there like, I think he alludes to this fact, like, you know, what if you run expensive things, do them like in idle time? And like, how do you know, isn't there, maybe I think there is some new fancy JavaScript API that's like idle, like do something when idle. So maybe you should look into that, or can't you use request animation frame to I know that runs really fast or whatever, but it's also like there's a way to use it that's like do this when you can.
Yeah, and that's sort of like request animation frames thing. It's like the next time, hey buddy, the next time you're animating a frame, try this.
But like that runs a lot, and like so would you combine it with a set timeout? Because then you're still using a set timeout, so it's like why.
Yeah, I guess you could. I mean, but you're just saying like you'd have to increment something, and then every time if you're like, if this is over 300, hey buddy, do this or something.
And what is it that you would need to do? Like, I'm trying to think of a thing. Like maybe it's like recording events, and then every 300 milliseconds, it like shoots off some data to the server or something. Maybe it's a tracking script. Scott, are you doing tracking?
Tracking script. Are you tracking, Scott? Are we helping you track people's?
All right, next data? Question. We got to move on.
Sianda Mampulo, sorry about your last name. I did a bad job pronouncing. So Sianda writes in, I've noticed on CodePen the navigation between pens doesn't move while navigating. I've had some problems keeping the navigation in place when dealing with items with slightly different heights. I think this makes for a better UX. Do you have any advice on keeping the pagination
to different heights is the key word in that question. Like if you replace six things with six different things, but they're all exactly the same width and height, nothing will change, you know? As long as you, when you remove the old and put in the new, that you don't temporarily collapse that element. You know, you kind of keep something there to keep the height that it was while you kind of are doing like whatever, an inner HTML change essentially. Yeah. So that's our only secret there. And of course it was considered, you know, I like that. Any website that I notice that every single time, if there's some kind of pagination and they've taken care to make sure that it doesn't move, I love that, you know, and a lot of it is just being smart about UI, thinking like, oh, is there some kind of pagination where I could put above the things that have variable heights, because then it will kind of stay where it is. Like I think of like Flickr photos that have all kinds of different dimensions. Well, the pagination is like fixed position on the left and right, or it's above it or something, depending on where you are on the site. Like, don't put pagination like centered below variable content stuff, because that's a bummer, because it moves around a whole bunch. It's obnoxious. So, you know, as far as advice, just think about it. Is there some way you can utilize position fixed or position absolute or something? Or is there some way you can put it above things that are of variable height? Or if you can't and you really like the pagination below, can you have multiple places where it can happen? Can you put them at the top and the bottom? We use that at CodePen sometimes. So, it's good. It's worth thinking about, though. The fact that you're thinking about it at all, good for you.
Height's tough. If it's all text, like a big, like you're navigating through blog posts, you're gonna have a tough.
One of those
time.
Things. Height but is like a fundamental web design images, concept. You know, it's one of those things that you just, if you deal with what it's a. It's hard to like explain to a beginner. So, you know, like you wouldn't walk into a beginner web design class and be like, always think about height, you know, but it's just something you kind of learn after years in web development. It's just one of those funky things that you can't really rely on. Rasmus Jures writes in, we use WordPress for all client sites and I have pretty efficient gulp setup with SAS compiling, concatenating, same thing for JavaScript, all resulting in a single CSS file and a single JavaScript file. But as soon as you start using a few WordPress plugins that all come with their own scription style sheets, and the whole limited HTTP request thing is out the window. I like to keep the amount of plugins to a minimum, but still. Is there a way to get our theme to intercept the plugin scripts and style sheets and combine them with my own in a way that limit the amount of HTTP requests? We covered this not so long ago, and I recommended something, and I'm going to come up with the name of it right now for you.
I've used WP Minify before, like a little script that smashes these down and, you know, all the include-y things and smashes it down. I don't know that it sometimes it would bomb out on me and break. So I don't know if it's like bulletproof every time, especially when doing it through a plugin, but maybe it's gotten better.
The one I'm referencing here is called MinQ. I will use it on CSS Tricks on production right now. I really like it because it just asks you for a list of the kind of the IDs that are enqueued. And all plugins do that, you know, in order to insert their own stuff, they need to enqueue a script and enqueue a style with and then each of those has an ID when that happens. And you just say, I want this one, this one, this one, this one, this one combined. You could have multiple queues if you'd like to. If you enqueue your own script, you could have it combined with your own if you'd like. If you're really trying to get down to one request each, you could do that. So yeah, I think it does a great job. I use it in production and it's kind of great. And it means that, you know, you're not doing this like locally or whatever. If a plugin updates while their CSS updates, it's still enqueuing it and it just kind of gets updated into the combined thing. And it, you know, it's pretty nice. It caches it as well, which doesn't matter as much for me because it just gets CDN cached for me anyway. But hey, it's got its own little cache. Cool.
Cool.
MinQ, really good one. All right. What do we got?
Joe O'Leary writes in, I'm a UX professional working for a large financial company and have been trying to champion pre-processing for all the right reasons. We are just now getting our feet wet pre-processing with SAS, more specifically Bootstrap's latest SAS version. As you may expect, we have tons of legacy CSS. Is it worth the time to reverse engineer any of this to SAS? Are the CSS to SAS tools good at this? What is your experiencing in modernizing legacy CSS?
Well, it's one of the big reasons that SCSS is so popular is because all your CSS is valid SCSS also. I'm sure you've heard that before, but It's pretty nice, and it's good for kind of beginners getting into SAS because you can just write CSS too, and it's fine. So yeah, I would say that that's part of the success of SAS is you can baby step into it. You can just kind of change that file extension or whatever and just start using the little bits of SAS here and there when you need to. I don't know that I would trust a CSS to SAS tool. That seems crazy to me. Like, does it heuristically find, colors that are the same and make a new variable and apply it and stuff? That seems like something you probably want to handle yourself. Or like, does it auto nest things and stuff for you? Like, ooh.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. What I would do in your situation, I mean, I don't know, but I would create legacy.scss, and that's like where all the legacy CSS goes, right? And then start chipping away at it. Like maybe break that up into partials. Like you break it up into whatever legacy footer, legacy header, legacy, you know, whatever body or something. Just start breaking it up. And then when you can either refactor that and move it into like a normal header CSS file or something. But yeah, just kind of like start with it all in one place and then start breaking out into partials until you get comfortable with partialing. And then maybe you can start nesting things or maybe break it up into really small modules, you know, and maybe it's in a legacy folder. That might be really great too, is break it up into really tiny, well-constructed modules. And then you can just refactor one at a time. Or maybe if you're on a team with, I don't know, six people, you could say like each of us takes four and we fix four of them at a time. So that's something. So
there is.
Reserve a conference room, a big table in the conference room.
I'd say like things like this, I often look and be like, I don't know if I'd, you don't need to spend a billion years on it. I even, as much as I'm like the literally the world's biggest fan of SVG icon systems, I think, I wouldn't recommend that the whole world switches away from icon fonts tomorrow. Like, it's not, and you know, like if it's already implemented and working okay for you, just kind of let her go. And then unless there's like major things that you need to address and you know that they can be addressed by an SVG icon system, then switch to them at that time when you need to, or when it's something is new and greenfield and you have the opportunity to, and you agree that it's a better system. Just like that with SAS, you know, like you don't need to upend your entire company just to switch to this. You can, you know, baby step towards it and get there when you get there.
Oh, good. Hey, Chris, how's Linda?
Love her. You know, there really is Linda. We should probably know more about her. I know a little bit, and I know that she's kind of badass, is literally the founder of Lynda.com. But, you know, that's what we're trying to send you. LYNDA.com is a sponsor of Shop Talk Show, and a lovely one at that.
You were going to tell us about your secret course.
Well, I have some of those.
Plotting.
I can do. Okay. It's there's some of the 3,000 on-demand video courses that can kind of help you do this. They say Lynda.com is for problem solvers, for the curious, for the people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to master Excel, learn negotiation tactics, build a website, or boost your Photoshop skills. Go to lynda.com/shoptalk. To feed your curious mind. So yeah, I was going through and I was looking at ones that appeal to me, Chris Coyer. So that there's one, you know, you can be a, you know, just searching around and browsing around, you're going to find ones that you like. But I was looking at ones that was like, oh, these are the ones that I'm adding to my list. Foundations of Graphic Design History, the Arts and Crafts Movement. How cool is that? You can like take college classes about the history of graphic design.
Wow.
There.
That's,
which is
that's
great because it's kind of like a break almost from learning. It's like sometimes you're like, I want to level up, isn't it? It's like sometimes you want to level up, but you're like, I don't really feel like watching a course on Angular tonight. You know, it's like, it's so like intense, you know? Like sometimes that's great that I know that I can do that, but sometimes it's like, I just want to like go to college for a minute and like kick my feet up and like chew gum. Watch something stuff about graphic design history.
Like, that's college to you.
Yeah.
That's good. Good.
One is creating brand identity assets. I think that's kind of interesting. Like, for example, like, what should I be doing at CodePen? I have a CodePen logo. We have variations of the CodePen logo. How should I make a package of this? Like what should I be doing? Should I have a deliverable of brand identity stuff that, like, in what formats should they be in? Like, what do people expect from that? How should I put that all together? It's a whole course on, like, getting that together, like having an assets package for your brand identity. I think that's awesome. Adobe Pen Tool fundamentals. Totally vital, right? I don't know. I just, at one point in my career, I had a job where I basically used the pen tool. It was like pen tool, the job. I got like hundreds of images a day, and it was like furniture and people and like electronics equipment and stuff. And my job was to make a bunch of very logical Photoshop clipping paths around all of it vector. And I just used the pen tool all day long. And I'm not like the world's master of it, but I am pretty fast and precise at using the Adobe Pen Tool. And I think it's been awesome for my career to know how to use that. If you weren't so lucky as me to have that job at one point in your history, there's a class on getting used to it. And it's just getting really used to like what all the keys are and switching between the different tools that you need to use the pen tool effectively and like zooming in to the right level and knowing like where to click to make a new vector point and that kind of click and drag kind of thing, and you know, when to make a square point and an arc point and all that kind of stuff, I think. And now with SVG becoming as big as it is, and Illustrator and other tools like that, using pen tools as a fundamental part of it, I think it makes you more kind of useful to your stuff. Anyway, I'm going on and on and on about this. Textured type techniques. Look at all that stuff. That was just me poking around and finding a few class things to add to my lynda.com playlist. If they're appealing to you, check them out. Do a search on Lynda for them. That's lynda.com/shoptalk. We got another question here, and then we'll get towards the end of this thing here. But yeah. Brandon L. writes in, I've done a few freelance jobs, and I feel like I've made all of my clients happy from a design standpoint. Good job, Brandon. The thing that makes me shudder a bit when I look back at them is the SEO. How much of that do you take on? How much do you contract out? I just can't help but think that my lack of SEO skills essentially puts me in a position where it's like, hey, hope you like the design I just built you, because we're pretty much the only people that are going to see it.
Oh.
It's rough, oh, isn't it? I've never quite thought of it that like rough. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if it's your job when they hire a designer necessarily that to make anybody in the whole world see it. I'm like, I don't know. Like, SEO is like a legit thing or whatever, but I don't know. I think you might be cutting yourself short if you think that if you don't do anything that you're the only person in the whole world that's going to see that website. I mean, people are finding it now somehow.
Well, and I think it's how you like how you want to do this. If you're going to do like SEO, you need to have a plan, right? Like we're going to have great title tags. We're going to have great, you know, content shipping regularly. We're going to have, you know, there's lots of different SEO white hat, just things that you, a plan for your website that you need to have. You know, did you have a good coding structure that's really hyper indexable? Did you overload keywords? You know, stuff like that. It's stuff to know. But yeah, you need to, I think it's a discussion, like what are your SEO goals? What keywords, you know, are you trying to target? You know, are you going to buy ads to get people to come to your website for those targets? You know, if the answer is no, then it's not your problem. Or if they don't care, they just want to have it, that's fine too. You know, we had a client, we just coded a decent site. I mean, like it just was better than the other like competitors in locally, and just massive SEO, like just tons of organic hits just for like a home builder in some town in Texas. And yeah, so it could just be, you just make a good site that people like and go to. So yeah.
Yeah.
And gets linked.
I don't know what to back tell you. Like, you can't just be like, hey, I made this site for you. It's a perfect design. It solves all the problems you have, and you really love it, and I really love it, and this was a good relationship. You can't walk in there and be like, but I'm so sorry, nobody's ever going to find it because I don't have SEO skills. Like, don't even go there. Like, just, that's not your thing. It's not, you know, I don't know. Like, You don't need it for every site. I know I'm not in client work, but like you are, Dave. It's not, do you ever be like, well, we did excellent work for you, client, but I'm afraid you're going to have to find your SEO work elsewhere. You know, like, I don't know that it comes up all that often.
No, I mean, like SEO can impact the work or something. Like, turns out this is not SEO, good SEO or something. And you're like, oh, I'll fix it. Don't worry. It's mostly just about links. I mean, I don't know. I sort of like the best way to think about Google is like, what do you think is fair for a search engine to rate you on and judge you on? And, you know, like a robot, what's it fair to judge you on? And then what do you like about good website? What makes a good website? I think that's kind of what the level of knowledge search engines are approaching, you know? What makes a good website? It's so weird, but I think that's what it is. It's like, you know, performance is a big part of the ranking of a website. So how fast your website loads, you need to go over to Google page speed insights and make that as close to 100 as possible. Yeah. And that what I would say is your job. I mean, but you know, and then maybe you're just going to beat the competition through speed because no one cares about that. So that's probably something you want to think about.
Okay. Forget all.
Yeah.
All this garbage.
Good luck. There are professionals you can hire and they can, you know, maybe you hire them once and they tell you how to do it. And then you just remember that. Okay. Go.
Oh, we're approaching the end of this thing. And I should say that Shop Talk Show, another thing that keeps us afloat over here at the Shop Talk Show is the Shop Talk Show job board. So if you hate your job, which we know for a fact because so many of you write in about it, that you do, check out shoptalkshow.com/jobs. And there's jobs there. It's powered by kind of the CodePen job board, which is also the CSS Tricks job board and stuff. So if you know, if you're looking for a job out there, come post it and you'll get your job posted on all those three sites for, you know, one low, low price. One of those companies that did this, which I think is really cool, is called Water Furnace. And to be perfectly honest, I think their website could use a little help. So I'm glad that they're hiring. But what's awesome about it is it's like an amazing company. They're leaders in geothermal energy, which I don't know how much you know about, but you can put your own geothermal stuff in at your house. I was like watching videos about it and stuff today, and it's kind of amazing how it all works. It's like a little more complicated than you think it is. It's like there's like good amount of science happening, but it's kind of like, you know, how like an air conditioner works and that like it has to run the heat engine like in reverse to make it, but it depends on the air that's around it that it uses to run that process. And it's like if it's based on using a bunch of cold air, it's harder to use, but it doesn't need to use cold air if it gets that air from like down in the earth, which is what they help install for you, like pipes that go all down in the earth that stay a little more consistently. So it doesn't only help you in the winter for heat, but helps you in the summer for cooling as well. It's like a double cool thing. And that's where like the majority of the costs of your energy bill comes from, is from heating and cooling and stuff, not so much like your light bulbs and stuff. Anyway, I was going way into that, but that's the company Water Furnace. But they're looking for a full-time front-ender, right? So pretty good. Like, I'm sure most people listening to the show are kind of like in the running for this kind of thing. They need you to have a degree, which probably a lot of you do, so, but that's kind of a thing. But I would suspect that that if you're good and you have a completion of some kind of program in these things too, that they would consider you, because it would be dumb if they didn't, kind of, because people are really good coming out of these things. And it's in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and they do need you to move there. But, you know, again, then you could be in the Midwest with me and your life will get better. So I recommend that. Pretty good stuff there. Check it out. We'll put the link to the job posting in it. But it's an internal job too, which I think is actually kind of cool. I know that certainly appeals to me. I'm the kind of the way that my brain operates. I like internal teams and like, what can we do to make ourselves a little bit better this week and a little bit better next week? And then we're going to tackle this, which I just know needs tackling because it's been around a while and it just needs help. And then we'll do this. And that, and if we do a good job over a long period of time, we'll see the growth kind of building. That's just the, that's what I like. That's how I like to work. And that's what you can do at Water Furnace. And I thought we'd combine that with a question at the end here. So Fred Barker writes in, he says, I know you get a lot of these, how do I get a job type questions on the show, but I think this one is a little different, and I'd love to get some input from us. After many years of feeling stagnant in my current job, I decided it was time for a change and just decided to spend the last 12 to 18 months learning everything I possibly could about web development and design, including countless hours on Treehouse, 26-week stint on Block's UX design course. Wow, I really dug in here, Fred. But it seems like no matter how much I learn, I can't keep up with the pace of the web development industry. I'd like to just build websites, as we say here on the Shop Talk Show, but it seems that nowadays front-end dev is expected to be a ninja wizard, Jedi, whatever, in HTML, CSS, jQuery, vanilla JavaScript, Angular, Ember, Backbone, Sass, WordPress, PHP, Gulp, Grunt, blah, blah, blah. Things, the words that come up plenty on Shop Talk Show, not to mention Photoshop, Sketch, UX, and all that kind of stuff. So he's feeling overwhelmed, which is FAQ territory on Shop Talk Show. But he's finds himself capable and knowing and good at this stuff, but finding it hard to keep up and stuff, and the landscape is so daunting. Yada, yada. You've heard this kind of thing before. Fred, what is it? Are you applying to jobs and they're saying no? It doesn't seem like that's the case, Fred. It seems like you've decided that the web development industry moves fast and you don't know what you think you should know. It almost seems a little bit like imposter syndrome-y, or that you've just, you know, you know what you don't know a little bit and it feels overwhelming, but it's like, why does it matter? I think you should apply for this job at Water Furnace and get it and just start building sites and get on with your life. Doesn't it seem like?
It's kind of like, it's that thing kind of, by the very fact that you know what this thing is and you know that you don't know it, you probably know more than most people know.
Yeah, that's weirdly cyclical.
Is that
weird? Yeah, you felt like one of the doors on the movie The Labyrinth or something, but it's like... The fact that you don't know means that you know, and then it puts you ahead of the people that know but don't think they know. And that,
So I think just apply, and be honest. Say I don't know Angular.
I don't know Angular, but I've done a 26-week course on UX and have a bunch of stuff under my belt, and I'm a problem solver and a go getter. And you'd be stupid not to hire me. Yeah. Don't say that, but like have that demeanor.
You chump face, dummy.
You could say you chump face, but like with your demeanor. You know? No, I don't know.
With your body language, a conversation, body language. Yeah. What's up, chump face? Hire me. Hopefully that works. No, don't. I think you're in a good position. I think I think there's a lot of people looking for junior help. It's kind of even the mid help that has more trouble. You know, the mid level that's having trouble getting hiring because people are hiring either senior or junior. So I think a lot of companies want to maybe bring you in and, you know, get you going. That's what I would say.
Good luck, Fred. Literally apply for the job at Water Furnace. I don't know. Or look at the Shop Talk Show job board. Anything. Anyway, that's about all we got for this.
Yeah,
rapid fire.
We should wrap it up. And I was just going to say, go over to Moz.com, Beginner's Guide to SEO. It used to be SEO Moz. Now it's Moz. They have a SEO like guide, and that's probably
seriously Moz.com question now. That's so confusing because it's like Mozilla.
They would have lost their SEO to check that out. Anyway, I think they're they have like tools to analyze your site and stuff like that. But I don't know. Just I would if you're interested, read. So anyway, that's all we got time for. Thank you for listening to another rapid fire episode. And if you hate your job, go get a new job, shoptalkshow.com/jobs. And if you, rate us up in your podcatcher of choice. We really appreciate it. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, shoptalkshow.com.
Boom, 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 boom